Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Oscar Westlund, and I'm very pleased to have you all here and to welcome our guest today, Raoul Ferrer, visiting us from Karlstad University to give his talk for the Digital Journalism Research Group and its focus seminar series. We will today learn from three different trends, and this is quite extraordinary because Raoul has a very good sense in his research to identify important emerging research areas within digital journalism and also managed to execute research into them in a very timely fashion. He finished his PhD last year, and it's being discussed as a very promising and very good dissertation, and he has published in many different journals already. He currently works as an assistant professor at Karlstad University in some of their larger projects that they're working with at the NODI research group. I'll let you present yourself more, but we are very pleased to have you here, Raoul.
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much, Oscar, Stian, and the entire group for having me here. Really, really excited to be here. When I see the list of other speakers of the series, it's kind of overwhelming. I thought I would organize today's talk in a way that I present an overarching theme of the topics that I'm going to be talking, and then I'm going to connect them to a specific study that I've made according to each of these themes. So you can expect that the first part that I talk about each topic is a little bit more softer, and then we go a little bit more research-wise, developing methodology and theoretical framework for each of the spheres. Before, though, I want to talk just very briefly about myself, because I am not a traditional researcher. My background is in web development, and I worked with that for quite a few years before I decided to migrate to academia. But now I teach media and communications and digital media analysis in Karlstad University, where I also do research. I'm part of a wider project where we managed to get quite a bit of funding for the next 4 years, where I look at especially digital journalism, processes of datafication and gamification. However, the next part of our research is going to be focusing more on engagement. As Oscar mentioned, I finished my PhD, and that is my thesis, which is, I'm not going to lie, it still feels weird to say it in paper. It still feels weird to hold it, but nevertheless, it's there. So the three cases that I want to talk about today are native advertising, gamification, and metrics. I'm going to start with native advertising, probably because it's the one that is most discussed in the industry, and for some of you, students might have a better grasp of that. And then I will move into gamification right before the break that we are expected to have. And then after the break, I will talk more about metrics, because it connects a little bit more with work that I will be doing in the future. So if we start with native advertising, for those of you who don't know, one of the important things about native advertising is that it's jeopardizing the typical division that we have between the editorial and the commercial aspects. And this is something that many researchers have pointed out in the past, and it's something that we know. That iron curtain, that separation between church and state has always been porous. It has never been very strict. However, the image was always there, that there was a separation between what journalists wrote against what the business part of the enterprise wanted to do. However, native advertising becomes a much more explicit attempt to break those boundaries. Suddenly we start having news outlets publishing stories just looking as stories, looking and behaving as regular journalistic stories. However, they are paid for advertising. And we're going to see quite a few examples from my research, but that's basically the importance for this. And for example, in 2014, when the New York Times came with their innovation report, one of the parts that they had is, we are actually going to stop this. It is no longer our need to keep the separation between the editorial and the commercial lines, and it is fine. So within the industry, they have made that change. A separation that kept the legitimacy of journalism to be able to say, no, we actually know what it is important for our democratic purposes. This is how we defined it. One of the reasons, also weird to cite myself, but at the time when we started looking at native advertising, there was a little bit done on especially more marketing and PR journals. We didn't have much in terms of journalistic literature dealing with native advertising. So I defined it as a paid content marketing where the commercial content is delivered adopting the form and functions of editorial content. So the attempt of it is to deliver commercial content that looks and works just like a regular piece of news. And this has other names that we've been working with: content integration, branded content, embedded marketing, editorial integration. So it is not always called native advertising, but we will all agree that native advertising is the name that has caught the discourse. And these are some of the things that I mentioned before. Why is this relevant? And well, this allows the host to create that narrative that it's going to fit their purposes, but by looking how a publication is making or addressing the information. It also makes there are a few issues there, but anyway, it makes also the message being spread in a way that attaches and appropriates the clout and the quality of the publisher. Even advertising is managing to publish their material through the New York Times. They get a clout out of that. And another reason why they are important and what they have gained importance is because they are managing to get across the value for the publishers much better than other types of advertising. As advertising has going down, especially the revenue for ads, mostly due from ad blockers, but also because people have grown resistant to different types of ads online, these type of ads, because they kind of replicate the format of news, have been much more successful at being accepted by the public. And therefore, they have been offering a much better quality for the money that publishers pay. And on top of that, commercially, they also have been very good, precisely because they are connected. The more successful they are, the more that they are going to make money. However, I normally not look so much about the commercial aspect of it, not because it's not important, but simply because it's not been my focus of interest. My focus of interest have been how the discourse behind it within the industry has been made. And here we can start seeing very important people within the industry that have started to make advances about how to make this division between the editorial and the commercial aspects of journalism start being diluted. And for example, executive VP of The Guardian saying that we want to create a platform where marketers share their content. This is basically saying we invite marketers and advertisers to just give their message through our platform. which of course it's that hint that we no longer have that division. Or something like this, from the executive VP from the New York Times, talking about sharing storytelling tools with a marketer. So obviously all this narrative is about collaboration with marketers instead of what had been prevailing until then, which was a much more adversarial roles, that we are here for the people, allegiance to the truth and all those norms and values that suddenly we see are being challenged from within the industry. And for me, the most revealing one, it's this one from Joe Reap, saying that editors, so the individuals who are supposed to keep that separation, are more excited about it because we no longer are asking ourselves the question of we are violating church and state. So we no longer have to care. And of course, this is problematic for many reasons, but mostly because the legitimacy of news is precisely about the fact that they are not beholden to political reasons or to commercial reasons. Of course, that's being diluted. Just to give you an image of what it is that we're talking about, there are two forms of presence of native advertising. One is in the feed of news. In this case, it's from The Guardian. Look very similar in the same feed, but of course, these are paid for by Edward Jones. These are ads. However, they come across as just regular content with a very tiny disclaimer that these are actually ads. This is in the feed, and we're going to see later in my analysis how the actual ads look like. And I will talk a little bit more about that. Now, if we take a little bit more the theoretical road into this, and I'm not going to go very deeply into it, simply because we don't have a lot of time, but I just want to showcase a little bit of the literature that has been addressing these issues, mostly for discussing maybe later on. But some of the literature in native advertising starts looking about not only the managers, which, as we've seen, they start seeing that maybe it's not as unproblematic or transparent, but also looking at this issue of more autonomy, transparency, and deception. What is it that we are doing here? We are selling products that are advertising, but they actually look like news. And we're making money out of it precisely because they look like news. People who trust a publication are going to read this with a better light because we know it's The Guardian or it's the New York Times. While experiments keep showing us that most users don't recognize these ads as ads. They don't really understand that they're ads. However, the entire discussion from the industry is the public knows. The public is aware that these are ads. We see no problem. Yet, our studies show that they don't. The other interesting move that we've made, and this is a new study that we've done all the data, but we haven't finished writing. It's from the visual boundaries of journalism. How can we tell something is not news and something is news? How can we tell that something is an ad, a native ad? Because the entire mechanism for this is about what I consider of a shiny camouflage, like making it look like news, but then saying, no, but hey, this is advertising, and making it look a little bit, hiding it in that way. So for us, this boundary conceptualization, there's a lot of studies on boundary work, on boundaries of journalism. We've taken it a little bit more from the perspective of the visual boundaries. What are the markers that tell us that something is news and not? And how do they manifest themselves in different publications? So the study that I did, and this was kind of the first empirical study on native ads in news, looked at 12 publications in 4 different countries. As I said, I live in Sweden, but I am originally from Barcelona. So for me, it was much easier to just connect these two countries. And then at the time, it was in the US and the UK where native ads were starting to explode. So I these are the 4 countries that I looked, the US, the UK, and then Sweden and Spain. And to look at what I was interested, I made a typology of the different types of native ads, and what were the characteristics that I was going to code for in order to make those comparisons. And I'm not going to bore you about the details of the data collection. I'm just going to say I spent an entire month, twice a day, going through all 12 websites looking for native ads. And it's a bloody pain in the neck, because it's extremely difficult to figure out what it is and what it's not. I must admit, Nordic countries are much better at disclaiming that something is an ad, but other countries are not as much. So let me just now, again, I have one example for all of them. So it's going to be a little bit of a slide about showcasing this, but at least it gives you a much better idea of how they actually look. This is the first case. This is from the Washington Post. A very clean layout, very similar to their long read format. And here the only thing that we see is that it's sponsor-generated content and that it's written by the United Technologies. Of course, this article has nothing to do with buy our products. They normally don't even sell to individuals. But it's about explaining how suddenly they are much more eco-friendly. So they try to establish a narrative that it's going to support or create a better light of their own products to the public. Here it's very interesting that there's no byline. So we don't know exactly who's written this. We apparently it's not going to be even written by the Washington Post. It's actually written by the marketer. Where you see WP Brand Connect, it's because most of these big organizations have created specific departments for native advertising, where they specialize in this. In the case of Washington Post, their specific department for native advertising is called Brand Connect. If we move forward, we see also USA Today, similar format, even a little bit much closer to their long format layout. And we have, at least here, we have a byline, but it specifically says for Emirates. This is not for USA Today. This is written for Emirates. Here the display is a little bit more explaining what it is. The story is provided and presented by our sponsor. However, we don't know the involvement of USA Today, whether how much did they do. Was this completely done just by Emirates and pushed into the website? And that is also another format that continues in the New York Times. However, here, they only say paid post by MasterCard. No idea exactly what that means. Did they write it? Did somebody at the New York Times write it? Here they also put the studio. Brand Studio is that department for the New York Times that does this. If you see some of these breaks, it's just because the software that I take to take the screenshots scrolls, and then sometimes it makes weird breaks. It's not exactly how it looked. Again, the story here is nothing about use more cards. It's about how travel is great. And somewhere in the story it says, And you know the problems with currency and having to exchange money? If you have a MasterCard, you don't have that issue. You can just pay wherever you want. So you can start and see that the message there, the story, is about traveling and vacation. How good is that for the soul? And how their product kind of makes it easier for you to enjoy a vacation. Now, if we go to Spain, and this pains me to say, but obviously it keeps happening on and on. Spain, sometimes it's a little bit more problematic. We're not particularly good on the ethics front. When we look at, for example, El País, here it tells us it is a sponsored piece of news, but it doesn't tell us who is paying. So where in the other examples we would see the logo, or it would specifically say who paid for this, here we don't know. However, when you start reading about this, and it reads a car with a plug, you start seeing that it's talking about Audi and the new eco-friendly Audi formats that they are producing and how good they are going to be. They're going to be, again, eco-friendly. So it's a lot of lifting the firm and the brand. Here we know who write it, but we don't necessarily know whether this is a journalist, this is a marketer, who does this person work for El País or not. An even more problematic case, this I struggled, and this is another of those methodology problems where you struggle doing certain choices. This I know it's a native ad because it is written on the public data of the, I guess the translation would be the Barcelona Comun, where they paid a large amount of money for El Periódico to write 10 articles that would favor public transportation. However, it is not explained here. So I am not necessarily sure whether this could qualify as a native ad. I know this is paid for, and it's supposed to make look the city of Barcelona better. However, it's not really displayed as an ad. So here we're kind of breaking that boundary of whether it's disclaimed or not, whether it's acknowledged. So this is even more of a problem. Another example, La Vanguardia. Here, they are very good, and they tell us that this person is an actual journalist. So here, okay, so this is written by a journalist, and it is sponsored by Avertis, which is a big company that makes infrastructure things. And that's another of the cool things about this. Some of these brands are really huge, and they don't necessarily sell products, but they connect them just to that creation. Now, if we move to the UK, the UK had a very mixed approach, an approach that I will explain has kind of taken off in later terms. Here also we have a byline. This is in association with HP. Again, very vague. What exactly means in association? Are they writing the story? Are they paying for the space? Very unclear, but it is locked into the home-sponsored business. So we kind of can see a few traits. Very similar to their main page. Almost no changes to how their regular news look like. This is the nested egg of native advertising. This is a page on The Guardian paid by Outbrain, which is the main broker of native advertising, writing an article saying, what is native advertising anyway? So it's a company that does native advertising, writing a story about native advertising and selling it in a native advertising format. But it is still the same way, brought to you by, and it's very unclear what that means. Now, The Guardian was the only ones that had a disclaimer about, they had three different types of nomenclatures, brought you by, paid for, and there was another one. And they kind of explained what it meant. So they did have a page where they disclaimed what were each of these definitions. And what I meant with before that the UK had also taken a different approach, the Times said, well, we're not going to try that yet. We're going to be trying paywalls. At that time, they didn't have any native advertising, and they went more for the paywall, which in some countries, especially in the Nordic countries, has shown to be a much more promising and less problematic approach. Now, I also promised that I looked at Sweden. However, in Sweden, at that time, there was nothing. There was no native advertising. From what I know from one of my colleagues, now we're looking at Norway, one of my colleagues in Bergen University, he knew that there at that point there weren't also in Norway. But this is how Dagens Nyheter looked like at the time. One of the interesting changes here is that it's riddled with ads. There's ads everywhere. And if we looked at what we're going to look in a moment, the big difference is that suddenly native advertisings don't have other advertising. Because they are already advertising. So they afford to take out all the other weird banners because they suddenly don't need it, because that is already paid for. Now, the interesting thing about Sweden, after I did this study, I was giving a talk at a media group, very, very committed journalists for the good of journalism, that were shit scared about this. And they kept saying, this is going to kill journalism. We cannot allow this to happen. 6 months after I had that talk, all of the major newspapers had already started implementing native advertising. The first one in Sweden was by Svenska Dagbladet, and it was called A Branded Story. And it just looked like this, which is kind of now the regular format. SVD Branded Story, sponsrat innehåll i samarbete med Nrona, which is not very clear exactly what it means. Very good story about I think it was the invention of Gore-Tex, or a Gore-Tex type of material, and how it came to be. So it's a very cool story. Not trying to sell anything, very valuable in terms of maybe not hard news, but a long story to read. But of course, they are selling their brand. And from then on, we just started getting all these massive native ads in Aftonbladet, in Dagens Nyheter, all of them. But they are all very good, and they've all taken the approach of showing annons. So we have annons pretty much everywhere. And I'm not going to go more into this. That's kind of how it works. And it's taken by surprise how quickly everybody has been accepting this as a fine format, when pretty much everybody has been discussing how problematic it is, and how our research shows that it's problematic, that people don't understand, that people tend to feel deceived. But also some of that research points to the fact that, yes, but they don't care as much. So we are still figuring out whether how terrible is this, how maybe not. There's always the counterpart of, well, this will pay for the good stuff. So something that I normally don't do in regular presentations, pros and cons, and this is mostly because of the type of audience we have. Pros, increased revenues. They are trying to be open about the fact that this is advertising. Some of this advertising is actually well crafted. It's not just a banner that tries to make your attention. Some of the information is very good. One of the first examples of native advertising in the New York Times was a very good, well-sourced story about the female population in jails in the U.S. So it was very interesting, but it was paid for by Orange is the New Black, which is a series that deals with that specific reality. And this thing that it may pay for the proper journalism, which I think it's always a very amusing way of explaining some of these strategies. The cons: readers don't always know it is advertising. The advertisers are technically stealing. Well, they are paying for it, but they are taking or appropriating the reputation of the publisher. And that means that if that becomes a trend, the publisher would lose some of that legitimacy and credibility because their trust is going to be taking a hit, and it puts a dent into the independence and autonomy of journalism. So, one trend gone, and we start looking at the next one. I'm not entirely sure where. We have about...
Maybe a little bit flexible.
A little bit flexible. I'm going to go a little bit maybe faster in this one. This is basically my dissertation project where I started looking about how news and games are being mixed in digital journalism. And of course, there's been games connected to journalism for over 100 years. This is the first crossword that was ever published. It was in the New York World in 1913. And it was an attempt to start bringing people, with the attempt of making it more popular, making it more entertaining. So they tried to bring tidbits that would generate buzz. In digital journalism, we've been seeing a much more convergence of both formats. And they normally go... Just give me a sec. I'm going to... There we go. Normally we use them in two camps. We have news games and we have gamified news. The difference between these two is that the first one are actually making a game. They make a game where they bring editorial or journalistic content into the game, but it's still about playing it and reaching an end. Gamified news use this the opposed system. Gamified news are bringing in game mechanics to the regular journalistic format. So instead of actually making a game, they are using game mechanics like points and badges and leaderboards in order to motivate people to do things. For the most part, to bring in the audience. And I focused more on that. For those of you who don't know about gamification, I'm going to quickly talk a little bit about it, because there's the misconception that gamification is to make something into a game, and it's not really true. The basic definition is this: it's the game of use, the use of game elements and game mechanics or game thinking in non-game context. So it's about not necessarily making a game, but using those strategies to enhance some type of motivation or entice an action. And when gamification came around, it came with a huge celebratory rhetoric. Books starting to come out about the gamification revolution, about how leaders can leverage game mechanics to crush competition, creating customer loyalty, how it's going to save the world, how it's going to revolutionize businesses, and again, just making this idea that we're going to revolutionize customer and employee engagement. And of course, these are people who are trying to... These are champions of gamification. And they had, at that moment, that idea that this was the way to go. And we had lots of different definitions where they talked about engagement, choices, progression, creating a social habit, somebody talking about true loyalty, creating a competitive advantage. So it was a lot of these very positive approach towards how gamification could create this form of reward substitution. We're going to give them a reward for them to come and read the news. However, as we started looking into that, we started thinking, well, maybe this is not that way. And then we start having definitions like this. And if you look at it, you start thinking, like, well, there's something missing about this specific definition. Here there's nothing about games. There's nothing about fun. There's nothing about enjoyment or engagement. This is about packaging, service, systems, feedbacks, value creation. This is a managerial approach to games. So a group of people started looking at, well, maybe this is not as easy as we thought it would. What happens when we just throw points to people? What are we doing to them? Is this really empowering them? Is not? What happens with the data that people collect? For gamification to work, we have to have a phone, a system that tracks us, that checks our behavior, that quantifies it, and that gives it to us. And we can see a graph, and it can push us forward. So what happens with that data? Who owns that data? How is that data used? What happens when it is applied to working environments? Is it okay that my employer is giving me badges just to do my work? What happens with my colleagues? Is it okay that we are put in a very competitive environment and that everybody can see a leaderboard where the best one is always at the top? And in the US, that's a much more common thing, but in the Nordic countries, it's not so common to be as competitive in working environments. So somebody who is always going to be rewarded as the best employee might get some resentment from the rest. And of course, about surveillance. What is it that is happening when we allow all these systems to quantify everything we do? When we go out running, when we go out buying, when we are working or studying. So there's a lot of problems. I don't know why the presentation keeps messing up. It's just... it's only my computer is losing memory. So there was a lot of critique about play losing its innocence, how it's being exploitative, the concept of labor, of play labor, how we can make people do things just because it's fun. Other discussions about gamification being actually bullshit, how is this is just about trying to sell things and to make more money. So there's eventually a conflict of logics in gamification. The hedonic logic, which is more about this empowerment, social change and meaningful activities, towards the utilitarian logic, which is more the let's make people do things. We want people to behave better, we give them a reward. So the idea is, how can we achieve both? And if you're wondering, okay, so how does this actually look? Well, this is Axis Analysis. It's a game from Facebook, and it has the usual things. It has levels, progression, resource collections, social graph avatars, and quests. Now, if we look at this, this is Skias. It's a web community, a platform for people who want to have healthier behaviors. That it's not a game, but uses the same mechanisms. So if you eat healthier, it gives you points, and then you go into the next level, and you can connect with people who have the same tendencies, and you reinforce behaviors, and so forth. And you'd say, well, we've always used games to do these kind of things, so what is exactly new? I would say that there's two things. It's the technological aspect. Now we can track and quantify behavior in real time and provide feedback in real time. I don't know if any of you have a smart watch or a tracker that immediately when you start walking, it tells you, oh, well done. Now you keep walking for 10 minutes more and you will reach your maximum score. So that's something that we have, that it's new. And the other thing is this kind of appropriation of play. The extension of video game culture as something that is good and enjoyable, that now it's kind of being applied to other things that make these affective and epistemological turns into what does that mean, that everything can be enjoyable. So it has that promise of engagement in power, and it has the skepticism of surveillance. These conflicts of logics connect very well to the ones with journalism. The ones that I discussed before, that professional one about we are here for the truth, we are here for democracy, journalism is supposed to inform the public to act as citizens, yet we are still a commercial enterprise and we need to be able to pay the wages for our journalists. So it has a professional logic and a commercial logic, and it works also in that way. So in my study, what I was looking at is, it's a little bit about what happens when we gamify journalism. Does it have an effect on people? How do journalists actually conceive this? And what exactly are they trying to do? So very quickly, I want to show just some of the aims, because my idea is to go forward to the examples, the four cases that I was dealing with. In terms of study rationale, I interviewed 56 people. It was a multiple case study, and then I did analysis of the systems. The four cases were this, and I will go a little bit more into detail for these four systems. The first one that I want to talk about, even though it's not particularly chronologically, it's the Times of India. And the reason why I want to talk first about this, it's because this is a massive platform that unifies a gamified system across 16 publications, not all of them journalistic. So it's also magazines and stuff like that. And then they have a unitary set of rewards for the entire platform, and some specific rewards for the Times of India, for the journalism one. And this is a very good example of how to figure out what is it that they're trying to do. If we see the type of rewards that they get, that users get, we can see that only the News King's badge, has anything to do with engaging with the news. All the other ones are about moderating the site, creating content, commenting on other people's comments, being an influencer, that kind of sharing on social media. And the other, and then you can get these badges, but you can get also points, and you're placed in a leaderboard. That is the leaderboard for the Times of India, but then you can check for all, which means all the publications that they have. So you compete with all of the users, and you can change it for the last 7 days, the last month, or the last year. Obviously, everything very personalized, very connected to what your personal experience as a news user is. And they are very good at explaining that this is a loyalty program. This is one of those, come here 10 times and you'll get a free coffee. So when we look at this adherence of logics, well, here it's a very clear idea that they are not trying to make people engage with the news. They are not trying to make people learn more about the current events. They are trying to sell more. They are trying to learn from the public. Now, when we look at how they adhere to gamification logic, here's a little bit more utilitarian. It's come back tomorrow, share some of your information, tell us what you like. That kind of stuff. So they didn't really try to make it look like a game, to be enjoyable as a game. This is basically what they were trying to do is, here, reward. You do that, we give you this. The next example is The Guardian. This was actually the first big publication to use game mechanics in order to make people do something. Very interesting approach. They did a crowdsourcing website where they dumped a bunch of PDFs for the public to go look at them. This was the MP, the Members of Parliament scandal back in 2009, 2010. And they knew they couldn't go through all the documents. That was out of the question. They they didn't have the manpower to do it. So they created a website where they put all the documents, and they told the public, come investigate, look at the documents, and then you are the one who's going to classify those documents and tell us whether this is something that it's important or that it is something we should investigate. Classify it for us. And then what they did is they put these progress bars so that people would know how much they had left. And then they had it's not really a leaderboard, but it functions very similar. The points are the lines that they have covered, and then kind of the community was going forward with this. When talking with the people at The Guardian, they were very clear that the game mechanics were there to try to entice people to join. So again, when we look at this adherence, here it was more of a professional logic. They sold it as, we want them to investigate things. We want them to make the MPs accountable. And some of the pictures they showed from the MPs, they deliberately chose pictures of the MPs that were kind of smiling with a smirk, because they thought that people would feel even more enticed to go and dig through their expense reports. So it was very much a conscious approach. However, from the gaming or the gamification logic, it was still a very utilitarian approach. It was still not, it didn't really look like a game. It didn't really try to make it fun. It was mostly about, yeah, just help us. Let's do this together and go through this material. Of course, go through this material for free. So this is when some of these problems start arising. This is the public doing the work of a journalist for free. The third example shifts a little bit. This is a storytelling technique. This is very much gamified. This is from a pirate fishing in Sierra Leone story, where you start as a junior journalist or reporter, and you have to accept an assignment. Then they give you the rules and how you have to move forward in the story. And as you consume the content, you go through the story. You have to watch clips. You have to collect data. You have to classify some of these data in your notebooks. And then you get badges. You go up in the stages. If you don't consume the content, you cannot finish the story. So the entire mechanism in which games are embedded here, it's so that you can move forward through learning about the story. So here it's everything about it. It's story related. You don't have to sign up. You have the option to share it, but you don't have to share it. You're not rewarded for it. The only reward is about the story. And therefore, when I made the analysis on how this goes into the logic of journalism, it added to the professional one. It is still about informing the public. And here, when it goes into the gamification part, it's more about the hedonic. Here, it became a playful approach towards journalism. How can people play with the news, even though it's not necessarily that way? The final example or case, it's from Bleacher Report, and I left this one as the final because it's probably the easiest to showcase how problematic this can be. What the Bleacher Report did is that they gamified the news production process. It was the journalists and the contributors that were gamified. And they were in a system where, according to their performance, they were getting points. And if they get points, they would get every different achievement that they would consider would get, they would get these points, and then they would be placed in a leaderboard with a specific category, from junior reporter to chief writer of level 3. According to this, all of these had different perks. If you were a chief writer of level 3, you have more access to the specific events, you get more bylines. So everything was kind of connected to their level in the system. They also had specific positions that were featured columnists. Here, they were, for example, the ones on level three, the perk that they would get is if you were a freelancer, you got an interview for a paid position at the Bleacher Report, which meant that a lot of people just were writing. People who used to write in different outlets, they just started writing only in this place because it generated more metrics for them. They also started changing the way they wrote, because instead of writing one piece a week, they were given more points if they wrote five stories in a week, shorter, but just... so they kind of changed how people were working. And this is how you could see their profiles. These were the profiles of their journalists. Very, very quantified, with different ranks on different things, with all the achievements, even though here they look all alike. You could hover on them and they would tell you more or less what they were. Different badges that they have collected. Then they were put into what was called the power grid, where all were put into a ranking, where you could see the most successful ones. Obviously, success was the metrics that they were collecting. So very, very problematic one. So here we can see that it is about the commercial logic. This was just about creating, churning as much content as possible for as little money as possible. But here it was very much gamified. Here all of the contributors were inside of this kind of game system. So they were very, very, very close to that. This specific one is very problematic because they were very successful at creating content, but it was bad content because it didn't. The only reward was about producing more. It wasn't nothing about producing good material, which meant that advertisers started going away from the system. But Time Warner bought the company for $300 million. And then they forced them to stop this system and started hiring much more professional journalists. So if we discuss, was this successful? Well, from the journalistic perspective, it wasn't, because the quality went to hell. But they managed to make a ton of money and then rebrand themselves as a proper journalistic entity. So very quickly summarized findings about this specific study. There was the way that the individuals and news organizations used gamification was very contingent to how they adhere to these logics, how they saw journalism or their role in a journalistic field, kind of pushed towards how they were using gamification. They have no perception that it actually affects what they do. This is something that they, for them, it's not really. Even though it is clear that in some cases it changes the quality and the shape of some of those pieces. And then some of the theoretical concepts that I thought about this was kind of, how do we study this forward? And I just came up with this idea of, according to these logics, where would we place these formats? And here is the cases. And I'm kind of running over time, so I'm not going to go much into this. But it's about where they navigate in these logics and how it is placed across this space. So just to go back to these pros and cons that I've been kind of discussing. Some of the pros are very clear. They open new outlets for engaging with audiences. They are very keen on attracting the youth, and the youth play games. So if we talked through them with game visuals and game formats, they might be much more enticed to engage with our stuff. They can generate a habit of reading news and create alternative forms of revenue. The game industry has been extremely successful at giving their products for free and then making people pay for extra features. So there's an attempt to do that in journalism as well. In terms of the cons, very complex to implement, especially because it requires technical expertise and a certain type of knowledge about gaming and how games work. It is expensive and time intensive. It could trivialize content, and I can imagine people who already read news feeling like, really? Now you're going to give me a badge for reading a piece of news, and how that could alienate already loyal readers. And it could incentivize just being there for the gaming part. I just go there today because I need to fill my quota, or I need to get my points for today. And I think that now we can take a break, and then after the break I'm going to just discuss more about the metrics and analytics part of the third trend.
Yeah? Yes, and while your presentation is not finished, I think we should give you an applause for what you have presented so far.
Okay, thank you.
Let's resume 20 to 2.
Sorry, I have to leave.
No, worries.
Enjoy the longer of the election. I've been working recently on a paper about the gaming disorder.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The critical design process. And one thing that I found, I don't know, the International Association of Games Users. And I looked up the methodology, and it's all about the game. Because they don't even use the term the public or the end user. And I found that very, so it fits in very well with the commercial
because it's something that I don't necessarily feel like but they almost make you take that super critical approach of like
I'll give you my card. I'm sorry, I must have been
off. Thank you.
I might send you an email.
Brilliant.
I'm a friend of the colleague of ours.
Okay.
Yes. We're in touch.
Yes.
So I read all the
I knew that I was coming here, and I thought, like, I'm obviously not going to say anything. But it's so you already said
it. Yeah.
And I'm calling
I think that nobody has told me that way. I'm not leaving because it's terrible. But thank you for the reassurance.
See you tomorrow. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no, I...
It was my first time doing it in the Swedish system. And I don't know if you get the
I just did the postdoc and there we grouped them into three, four groups, and then we did like the proper everything that everyone said in them and review it. So I don't know, but if, do you know the committee?
I'm very excited about meeting.
many of my best academic friends have applied. So it's, So there's probably going to be, because now we're not involved anymore, we just give statements, the animation statements, and then they will have a new committee, I guess. I saw in the announcement that the
of course, all this is very familiar stuff. But I actually did my PhD on legendary English. So I've been very interested in that. Also, I mean, there's some things with more like Thursday, because they have the resources. And if you don't like it, they can be not whatever.
No, but I mean,
any longer, but
more. Yeah, probably now less, but for example, Juliana Roberts is the person who's been just finished another, even more famous about the Syrian war.
And they also had all these other projects about
certain scrutiny.
I know.
Hopefully, I will know by then.
Yeah, you will probably know by then.
Thank you.
I'm joking. I'm not going to agree with that. So this last part, and we have about, I'm going to talk for maybe 15 minutes more, maximum 20 minutes, and then we can have a short time for discussion if you guys want. This last part, it's something that you started seeing about yesterday, it's more about metrics and analytics and the use that news organizations have from them. And I'll start with a quote from the host, because it's always good to just pander a little bit to the person who invites you. But this is one of the ideas of how we consider data in the newsroom, not necessarily as something that happens outside, but something that can be quantified from inside. And there is something that Seth and Oscar give us is a few lenses on how we can look at the use of this data that that it's being used. And for the most, they talk about big data, and I kind of use it in relation to the data that news organizations collect from the use of their audience and how this becomes an integral part of their own production. And for those of you who are yet not too familiar with this, eventually you will, there are lots of different organizations. Chartbeat being one of the non-proprietary organizations who provide these metrics, but there's a ton of them. The news organizations use, some of them are products that they embed into their systems, some of them are being built by themselves. For example, The Guardian has their own system called OFAN, and the New York Times has been building a system that looks like OFAN, and they look sort of like this. It's basically a dashboard where they tell editors and news workers how their whole organization is going. For example, this is OFAN. This is a screenshot that like, looks extremely blurry from The Guardian. OFAN is such a beast that it only can provide information for the last 15 days. It collects so much data that they have to store that data somewhere else, and OFAN itself can only give that content for 15 days. This is another approach. So they all kind of look very similar. And the premise here, it's more that... and it keeps giving me this issue with... that there's this process of quantification. Now we get to quantify things. We get to quantify the behavior of our audiences, the performance of our writers, not only in terms of production, but in terms of monetary conversion. And this is kind of being embedded into the input, how news organizations are understanding their world, and also into the production that they're making. There is fairly little looked into how the journalists themselves are understanding their reaction to metrics. We have looked quite a bit into how the metrics are being used in the newsroom, but not so much about how they are being understood. So what I try to look at is, I wanted to look at their own reflexive perception. How is it that they understand what is happening with that? And these were some of the research questions. Something that eventually you are going to have to do to figure out how to write research questions for your CIOPS out there. And here I go back also to a few theoretical points of departure. Here I started looking into more epistemologies of journalism. What is it or how journalists make and decide what knowledge is, and how they create knowledge, and how these metrics are kind of becoming a factual evidence of journalistic performance. If now we can have the idea that an article has been read this many times, this becomes a fact. And for most of these people, that is what they need to know. And the other idea is about data power in itself. So how the existence of these metrics perpetuates that need to know how you're doing. It's kind of a metric that shows whether people are reading my stuff, whether I'm having an impact as a journalist, or whether how much a news organization is worth according to the views they have. And then, again, these logics of journalism that is kind of the red thread in some of my work. How informing journalists about their metrics is going to affect how what they think that they should push. Is it good to push a story that they know it's going to be very successful if it's not particularly good? So, for example, talking about the Kardashians might bring a lot of clicks, but it might not be a particularly good journalistic material. So that negotiation about how much do we have to push something that will generate buzz against something that is more socially relevant. Study rationality is something that I've been working for a while, and I have not been able to finish a concrete idea for something for some writing. This is something that Oscar and I have starting to work about how can we bring this into a more concrete piece of that can be published. But I took most of this data from those four organizations that I talked about, so I'm not going to talk about them that much, but I've expanded it with other data from other organizations, mostly to expand the geographical reach. And here, since metrics are not that easy to show, and I've been talking for a long time, I think I'm going to jump more into the findings, because I think that here the findings themselves are a little bit more interesting. So the first is that slowly, but very steadily, metrics have become central. And this is something that you guys have started looking at. But eventually, it's not just at the business organization level or at the technological level. It's also within the newsroom as well. How much space the discussion about metrics are taking in editorial meetings, and therefore how much editorial choices are made according to this. And this is a quote from an engagement editor from The Guardian, discussing that they start every meeting or every day a meeting with what worked well and what didn't. This is, again, a reflection on audience behavior on the website. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the criticism towards this in a little bit. The other thing is the analytics and these metrics becoming a measure for journalistic success. Defining some KPIs, some of these key performance indicators of what good journalism is. So here it's more translated that success into how people react to news. So when I discussed with them about how the did they know that their story was a good story or a successful story, most of them started by discussing, well, you know, if it's a well-sourced story, if it has a proper language, if it tells the truth, which is basically what you learn when you start studying journalism. Then when I discussed with them, yes, but how do you really know? Like, how can you tell? Then they all started going, well, I mean, if it's created a lot of likes, if people have talked about it in social media, if it generates a buzz, if a lot of people are reading it, if they read the entire thing instead of leaving the page in the middle of the article. So they kept going back to those metrics in order to explain how they knew that this was a good story. Even though their norms and what they learned was a good story is this, I get to tell whether my story is good by the metrics that it generates. So it's kind of becoming that exchange for the journalistic success. This is another quote from a journalist at Bleacher Report. We know a story did well if the engagement is high. And then here I ask, so what is engagement? And engagement is the time they spent on the story. How far down they scrolled, how many shares, comments, all the interactions a piece generated, it shows us that a story did well. So this is an example of how important these metrics are to the journalists. How they make an assessment of their own performance as a journalist according to these things. Here for me the interesting part is that they conceptualize engagement through these metrics. It's through the technical application of engagement, which is a big problem, because there's a lot that these softwares cannot tell from the audience. So these are technological pieces that calculate a few things, like, for example, how much time people spend, how much, but they don't know how much is the emotional implications that a story has in somebody. One of the colleagues here at the department, Bente, shared with me a story that apparently became very big here in Norway about a player, a gamer that died, and a lot of kids showed up to the funeral. And I thought that that was a very good example of this, because the parents of this kid were extremely surprised because they didn't know the extent, because they could only see this kid play on a computer, and they could not know the extent of what the impact that this kid was having. For me, metrics are a little bit like that. We can only see what the technological interface is letting us. We don't see the emotional aftershock that the news are going to have. Now, the third findings are more about the institution in itself. So this idea that journalists learn how to be journalists by experience, they know what news is, and they it's this nose for news, it's this personal intuition, this more tacit knowledge. It kind of starts steering. Now they have data that supports what they thought it was going to be good. And we can see this when the use of metrics, for example, when they are dealing with their homepages. And they look at metrics, and if the metrics are not matching their intuition of how a story should do, they ask for changes. Look, this is not working well. It should be working well. Let's change the title. Let's change the format or some pictures and see if it picks up. Or, hey, this story is working much better than we thought it would. Why don't we push it in social media? So suddenly they are making decisions that are informed, that are organized through explicit knowledge that they can apply to their own intuition. So it's that interaction. And here this a little bit of this reflexive, this kind of debate whether we are using our intuition because we are journalists, or we are using the metrics because that's actually data, and how they kind of resonate with that. And for example, this idea that we make informed the decision. In the past, it was only us and our journalistic intuition what allowed us to bring in, let's say, our judgment on what news is. And suddenly now we make those decisions informed by the data that we collect. Now, if we wrap it up and we go back to these four E's, we can discuss kind of how this data that they collect goes back into it. In terms of epistemology, which is that capacity to create knowledge and how that knowledge is being created, well, yes, this metric becomes, by definition, a performance metric. They check how something is doing and how a news story is doing. And then eventually it has been changing how they see success. And therefore, it's much easier to write about something that they already know it's going to be good, because in previous times it has generated enough metrics. from the time the idea of expertise, again, the status, authority of some of these journalists, it's increased. If I know that thousands of people are reading my stories and I know that my fellow colleagues it only gets 100 reads, suddenly my authority within an organization rises. And we can see this, for example, in social media with influencers. The authority that a person with 2 million followers has, regardless of their qualifications, regardless of their expertise, just by the fact that they can reach a much higher audience, affects their idea of expertise. Of course, in terms of economics, these are huge mechanisms for news organizations to legitimize the price in the market. If they have a huge amount of traction, they can negotiate a better price with advertisers. They gain power by being able to show this. And for me, I think that the ethical one, it's a very interesting one because it's probably the least obvious. What exactly is it that we're doing when we're allowing the behavior of people choose our or entrench into our journalistic integrity? And I think I have it later. And now I'm going to discuss that ethical a little bit more. But this is kind of the conclusion that I want to make about this specific study. And it is that it is about journalistic performance, but it is also about how they are consider them to be helpful to take better decisions. That it's not necessarily an usurpation of their intuition. And again, this is a reflexive account. This is how they think. They don't see it as something problematic. They see it as something that allows them to make better decisions and that it's going to push forward. So they downplay that dependence on the metrics. And I want to finish with this specific quote here, and because I tend to ask about these questions about, well, but what do you think about the role of journalism for being more democratic, about you deciding what is news, not the public deciding what is news. And somebody told me, well, you know, let's think it this way. If I publish something that I think it's very good for the democratic reasons of journalism, but now I have data that tells me that nobody is reading this, am I fulfilling those needs, those democratic function of journalism? However, if now I know that people are reading a specific type of story, now I can frame it in a way that it's going to fulfill my democratic duty, but reaching a much wider audience. And of course, that's a perfectly valid discussion. And I think that that is kind of the interesting part of the development of the quantification of the newsroom and how we can make sense of this. So let's go back to these pros and cons. Pros, it provides insight. It shows about what readers like and how they use the publication. So there's a lot of new information about how things are going. And it helps with the monetizing and advertising. So it's also a business thing. And for example, if they get a lot of traction, it can legitimize that. If I have to fight against a specific source of interest, I can go and say, well, we are actually have these many readers across the entire country, and it can legitimize them that way. Of course, it has its cons, and it's that suddenly we are trying to make ideas of what the audience is just by offering a technological algorithm that quantifies things. And that it can form a vicious circle where journalists are depending more and more on these audience metrics and eventually just producing what the audience wants, which is kind of the problem. And that generates a risk of what are they selecting, that it's worth to be news. What is it, the topics, and how do they react to it? And to end the presentation, I just want to show you a little bit of where this is going, because things have already changed from some of these interviews, and we start going into something like this. Robot journalism, algorithmic production, how all these forms of data are being embedded into news production itself, bypassing journalists. And if you say, well, but that's not necessarily anything to do with metric data, this is about data collected in the wild and then how it is being pushed. This ties with this, and this is my final slide, I promise. This is from MidMedia, and it comes from the Solder Personalization Service. This is an algorithmic service that what it does, it automatically collects all the metrics and audience data that they have, and instead of showing it to editors so that they can make the analysis themselves, it analyzes all that data, and what it does is that it presents the editor with potential topics to cover. So suddenly these metrics are being used to automatically select content. Of course, that content then has to be written, so it's not necessarily the algorithmic production of news. But it is putting into work all this data they are collecting about audiences to make automated decisions on content. And this is kind of where, for example, some of the Swedish outlets are going. And I'm sure that eventually, if it's not already here in Norway, it's eventually going to come. So it's a personalization of data according to metrics of people. And with that, I am going to open the floor to questions, discussions. I don't bite, so you get to ask whatever you want. If you don't, I will ask things to you. So,
thank you, Ro.
So, yes.
I have one question regarding the latter part of your presentation.
Yeah. The metrics.
So the way you are conceptualizing and framing this is very much within a journalistic context.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a
very very cool idea, and I think that they're one of the interesting things about these topics, and gamification is one of them as well, that they have so many angles that can be used, and absolutely decision making is one of them, and I think especially this last part, this is kind of bypassing decision making or algorithmically charging decision making processes, which I think that is extremely problematic. I am not particularly read in decision making processes or literature, but absolutely this could be a perfect case for that. not only from the individual, like how do humans make these decisions, but also what does it mean to make a program, a software, make those decisions? Because my hunch is that they're probably going to get very good at it. Yet they are not necessarily human. So, absolutely, I think that there's a lot of potential for looking at it from that sense, from organizational perspective and from more decision making. So, thanks for the comment. Not all at once, please. Now, so what are your thoughts into, for example, organizing things according to what the audience wants? About, is this something that sounds problematic to you, or is it something that, as a younger group of people, thinks that that's of course we should do it that way? And I would agree to that. And I can collect a few comments, and then I can make a comment to what you mentioned.
Yeah, I think it depends a bit on the extent to how much it's used. Yeah. If it's just like 5% of the output, I'm sure, but if it's taking over the job of the editor, it's more...
If I read what you're saying, it's more of a balance. But a combination of both.
It can be a good tool, I think. Yeah. It shouldn't replace the editor.
Yeah. Yes.
And if it helps the journalist with the package, so he can give the democratic news in a package that sells, it's a good thing, I think.
Yeah. And Evan, you had a comment? No. And again, this is something that it's not necessarily new in that discussion. Like, for example, I think it was it... During my PhD, I lost the track of time, so I don't know when things happen in the world. But somewhere there was the problem of the kids that were trapped in a cave in Thailand. And there was a huge global focus on that story. These last few days, we had something very similar, a little bit, much sadder, but similar in Spain, where a toddler fell on a well. And I don't know if it reached here in the news. And, of course, he wasn't in a cave. It was very clear that probably the kid was dead. And it took 10 days to recover the body. And what made a big splash is that some outlets had been discussing this as, this is great. Because there's so much people reading our stuff. Because it creates such a demand for this specific story. A specific kid fell on a well, the entire country is trying to save it. So there was almost that discussion of, let's hope they take a little bit longer to reach him. And that's not driven by metrics. It's driven from the same mechanism of what it's more popular against what it's more actually democratic, if we want to call it. So it's kind of informs the same discussion. And of course, some outlets tried not to focus on the more carnage type of thing that, oh my God, we found some hair and from the kid in the walls of the... And I understand from the editor perspective of we're going through a rough patch and we need to make money somehow. If this is giving us more eyeballs and more money, we'll do it. But it is very difficult to justify. So I agree probably that a balance in that sense is probably better. But it is a very complex, I don't have, I'm not very normative. I don't have the truth, and that's fine, I guess. Yeah. Yes, and I think that would be an interesting experiment. But they would tell you, well, this is our prime space, and we're not going to waste it on a story that nobody wants to read. That's probably what they would say. And to a certain degree, you could, like, for example, how they look at this, what I was mentioning about how they look at the homepages, and they look at the metrics. And if something is not doing well, they make changes. If it's still not doing well, they let it drop. Because they value that part. That is what brings in the people. So I think that it would be very interesting to check who would dare to go and say, oh yeah, there's people still being killed in Yemen. Nobody cares. Let's put it on the top. You know, that's people like Al Jazeera who have a little bit of a different approach to their financing. It has changed, but those type of outlets can afford doing that, but more commercial oriented. Yeah. You had a...
Yes, I wanted to ask a final question before we resume the session. The class here attending have elaborated with two concepts of their own and defining them based on literature and lectures and applied it with a sort of research activity. And what you're doing here is somewhat similar. There is a combination, although it's three concepts, gamification and native advertising and metrics slash analytics. And I'd say that a sort of underlying rationale for all of your three trends is that of a advertising finance business model. And you do a lot of research also on one more key concept, that is engagement. As we're now seeing the whole industry shifting towards having reader revenue as the main source of income, with Facebook and Google getting most of the revenues, could you elaborate a bit on your concepts in the context of reader revenue? Because gamification with the intent of making people loyal and paying is one thing. Native advertising in relation to reader revenue may become something different. And also metrics, where you don't have to comply with the industry standard, the sort of industry currency that you're measured against in relation to others in selling ads, but rather you can develop, as this example here, your own proprietary platforms for really knowing the metrics useful for subscription.
Yeah, it's a very, very good question, and it's, I think that's something that will require a lot of time to be able to even start getting proper answers to. But for example, one of the things that we've seen, most of the generalist magazines are starting failing, and the ones that are really good are the ones that are very niched. And that's because they are very good at talking to their audience. So they have established a relationship to their audience, and they can go and say, well, you who like this and nobody else is giving you this, give us money for it. And they're good at doing that. If we go back to the generalist type of news, what I think has happened is we can get this for free everywhere. We can get it from Facebook, we can get it from Google, so we're not going to pay for this. And I think that it's by establishing a better relationship with their audience. And for example, The Guardian has been very good at doing that. And The Guardian is one of the few ones who has been getting more and more revenue directly from their audience. As if they can frame it as an outlet that it is for a specific group, I think that it might work. I think that the time has come, and many other industries have gone through the same thing. So music, for example, is you want music, you need to pay us. And you pay for the music that, or connected with advertising, but some sort of that. Netflix has done the same thing, HBO. I could see, and we're actually seeing it in news. It's actually happening. What I don't know is how well it's going to stay. But the paywall is kind of functioning, and I think that eventually it's the way forward. I think that people are starting to understand that we cannot have great news for free all the time. We cannot have great movies for free all the time. We cannot have great music for free all the time. And more people are willing to pay for those things. So I do think that eventually that's kind of where it's going. But it's about establishing and creating your own audience so that the engagement is there.
With that, I think we need to finish.
I'm here if you guys want to ask something.
Yeah, I was going to say, you stay for some...
Yeah, I can stay here for a bit. I know Oscar needs to go, so...
Okay. thank you, Raul.
Thank you.